earlier today, I signed an order appointing Robert Herr as special counsel for the matter I've just described. This appointment underscores for the public the department's commitment to both independence and accountability in particularly sensitive matters, and to making decisions indisputably guided only by the facts and the law.
Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing today that he's appointing a special counsel to look into the handling of classified documents tied to President Biden. Earlier today, the White House confirmed another set of documents was found, this time at the president's home in Delaware. A previous set was discovered at one of the former offices he had in downtown Washington. Both sets of documents are tied to his time as vice president. It is the second time in just 2 months that Garland has appointed a special counsel to investigate how classified material ended up at the home or office of a U.S. president. He appointed one in November to oversee the investigation into former President Trump's handling of classified documents that were seized at his home at Mar-a-Lago, and a separate investigation into his actions on January 6th. Here to talk about the two cases and compare them is Bradley Moss, national security attorney. Welcome to Press Play.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Great, thank you. Well, are you surprised at how quickly the Attorney General called for a special counsel to investigate this?
No, not necessarily. I mean, look, at this point, this is very much a political optics issue for the Attorney General. The special counsel being appointed in the Trump matter, it was raised because Donald Trump had announced his next run for the presidency. And so there became an issue of having the opponents, Justice Department investigating Donald Trump leading up to 2024. But for this particular matter, given that there's already a special counsel into the Trump classified documents issue at Mar-a-Lago, given that there's multiple different locations now where we've learned Mr. Biden had classified records during his time as a private citizen, given the political sensitivities, I wasn't really surprised that they appointed a special counsel. I don't view it as changing anything. Ultimately, whether it was a special counsel or the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, that person ultimately will report to Merrick Garland, and Merrick Garland will have the final decision. But I think it was meant to provide some political cover to the process and try to reassure the public.
Especially since this special counsel, U.S. Attorney Robert Herr, worked in the Trump administration. So that would seem to be a move to insulate Garland from any charges of being political in this matter.
Correct. I mean, this certainly isn't someone who Donald Trump and his media lackeys could easily portray as, you know, a quote unquote Trump hater. This isn't another individual who was working on projects against Donald Trump, who was part of the quote unquote deep state, anything like that. It's not going to be as easy of a foil for them to use. Now, obviously, if Mr. Herr does not find or does not make conclusions that Mr. Trump would prefer, there'll be political attacks all the same. But it provides a measure of political cover, at least on the periphery, for Merrick Garland.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the similarities and the differences in the two cases. First of all, how many documents do we know so far were classified and were removed from where they should have been and found in either the office or the home of President Biden?
My understanding from the reporting is that there were as many as 12 or 13 documents. And to be clear, one classified document sitting outside an authorized location is a problem. It's a breach of national security. It shouldn't have happened. And the number of documents at issue, in my view, isn't really the key issue here. What you have is two individuals, Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump, both of whom through their staff appear to have originally accidentally mishandled classified information. What you also have now is two very different approaches the two have taken to responding to efforts to return those documents to the federal government and put them in proper storage and handling. Mr. Biden's team, as far as we can tell, is doing it the way you're supposed to do. You notify the government immediately. You have it all returned to the government so they can properly store it. You cooperate with the investigation. That's what you're supposed to do. Mr. Trump's team did the exact opposite. They obfuscated, they delayed, they submitted a statement from one of their lawyers that ultimately had false information. They did everything they could to potentially conceal where the relevant records were located until the federal government finally had to go in with a search warrant. That's why Donald Trump faces real criminal liability here. And as far as I can tell, Mr. Biden and his staff do not, at least at the moment.
What would rise to the level of criminal liability? Would there have to be motive involved?
Sure. So motive is one possibility. So if this wasn't accidental, if there was a deliberate intent to and a willful intent to take these documents elsewhere, whether it be for purposes of selling it, for actual espionage, just because you thought it'd be cool to have a whole ton of classified documents sitting around in your garage. If there was actual intent, that's one aggravating factor that the Justice Department would consider. It's not a necessary requirement, but it is certainly one that they would take into consideration about whether or not to actually bring a charge. The other one, and this is where Donald Trump got in trouble, was obstruction. If you accidentally mishandle, but then you obstruct the inquiry to recover the documents, that will tick off DOJ real quick, and that will get them to consider bringing a charge where they otherwise may have just been happy letting you off with a slap on the wrists.
Right. And also there's a difference because one is a sitting president and the other one is not. So one cannot be prosecuted, at least while he's in office, and the other one can.
Right. And as you know, as the Trump team told us for 4 years, you know, an incumbent president can't be indicted. That's actually not a law. That's simply a DOJ policy. I have no reason to think they would go against the policy here. That leaves, you know, obviously impeachment as the relevant political and constitutional mechanism to come into play. But Donald Trump no longer has that protection. So he certainly could be indicted even if Mr. Biden engaged in conduct that would otherwise cross the criminal line.
But what does it say to you that we have two presidents taking classified documents out of the place where they're supposed to be, and they are found in relatively unsecured locations in both cases?
So the classified world is completely unwieldy, and there is an emphasis on overclassification, as many of us have said for a while here. That doesn't excuse mishandling. It doesn't excuse sloppiness. But when you have this large universe of records, there are going to be mistakes. That's going to happen, even for the most good intentioned and good, you know, good faith efforts of these staffers who were boxing things up for Mr. Biden in 2017 and for Mr. Trump in 2021. What matters in the end from a criminal and a legal perspective is what you do once you realize you messed up. If you do what Joe Biden's team appears to be doing, you can likely get off with only a slap on the wrist because you did it properly. If you do what Donald Trump has done so far, you put yourself in real trouble and real likelihood of facing a criminal indictment.
Right. And so then what could that entail if he is criminally indicted, especially if he is running for president, as he says he is, and he's on the campaign? What could that mean?
Well, it would be sort of like a recycling of what we saw in 2016 with Hillary Clinton being dragged before the Benghazi Select Committee right in the heart of the campaign. You could certainly envision, if he is indicted and if he somehow nonetheless gets the nomination from the Republican Party, that this trial would be going on, whether it's the documents case in Mar-a-Lago or the January 6th case we expect to eventually come out. You could imagine there'd be a trial in the lead up to the election. I personally don't anticipate that he would win the nomination if he were indicted, but nothing's out of the realm of possibility. And there is no precedent for such a situation on the campaign trail. And there's no exclusion in the Constitution that would say that an indicted and prosecuted and convicted individual can't serve as president. There's nothing in the Constitution about it.
Interesting. Well, I imagine that this is going to take on a massive political life of its own now that the Republicans are in control of the House and promising all sorts of investigations, especially into President Biden and his family. So what do you anticipate in terms of the media and political circus around all this?
I think it's going to go to 11, as a famous Lion character in a movie once said. Everything's going to go to 11 now, because not only is it Donald Trump in trouble facing potential criminal liability, but now we know that Joe Biden engaged in similar conduct in terms of at least the mishandling of the classified documents. So if there is an indictment of Donald Trump, you can be sure there will be howls of political outrage from the right. You can be sure that this new committee that's being set up by the new Republican House will be trying to look into this as much as they can. There'll be lots of political, you know, gamesmanship here. Ultimately, the facts will go where they go. If the Justice Department sees a case to bring against Donald Trump, they'll bring it. if they see a case be brought against any of Mr. Biden's staffers right now, they'll bring it.
Bradley Moss, national security attorney. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
Well, speaking of going to 11, coming up, we'll remember the guitarist Jeff Beck, who died this week. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. That's the guitar solo from Goodbye Pork Pie Hat off guitarist Jeff Beck's 1976 album, Wired. Jeff Beck died Tuesday at the age of 78 from bacterial meningitis. He was known as a guitarist's guitarist, twice inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, once with the Yardbirds and once on his own. He came up with contemporaries like Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton, but he never achieved the same commercial success they did. KCRW DJ Dan Wilcox is here now to remember Jeff Beck. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Well, talk a little bit about that solo. Why does that stand out to you?
Wow. Well, it's got a lot of the ingredients that make Jeff Beck, you know, one of the all-time guitar greats in it. It's got a, you know, nice kind of a lyrical feel to it. And then, you know, he kind of switches it up with a little bit of distortion and feedback, which was something that he really pioneered. You know, he had a knack for finding great instrumentals to kind of showcase his insane talents. And that was one of them.
Yeah. And let's talk about his insane talents. As I said, he was considered a guitarist's guitarist. What was it about him that made him such a fantastic guitar player?
Well, I think he was definitely a pioneer. I mean, he had an incredible technical ability as a guitar player. He had an amazing feel. His, like I said, his style was very recognizable. I think you could always sort of pinpoint a Jeff Beck solo or his playing whenever he was guesting on other people's songs. But he was also a pioneer. You know, he was one of the first to sort of use distortion feedback, you know, kind of fuzz tones in his playing with the Yardbirds that really put him on the map. He had some big shoes to fill. He was hired by the Yardbirds to replace Eric Clapton.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, no easy feat, but he really made a name for himself and kind of followed that same muse throughout his career.
Interesting. Okay, so that was back in 1965. So he's about, what, 2021. Let's hear one of his tracks, one of those Yardbirds tracks. It's called Heart Full of Soul.
Well, I will never make her sad. I've got a heart full of soul.
So, yeah, you hear that fuzzy guitar sound there that you just described. And really, the Yardbirds were huge back then. They prefigured, I guess, you know, the coming wave, the British wave, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who.
Yeah. Yeah. That was before, you know, Led Zeppelin. And even though Jimmy Page eventually joined the Yardbirds around the same time, went on to, of course, form Led Zeppelin. But yeah, Jeff Beck was in there first. And that's, you know, that kind of raga sort of sound, almost kind of like an Indian sound that you hear. That was like a year before the Rolling Stones, Painted Black, or you know, before the Beatles started to kind of get into that similar type of sound. And so, he really was a pioneer with the instrument.
Right. And then did Jimmy Page replace him in the Yardbirds?
Well, they were together for a brief time. And then Jeff Beck left the Yardbirds to form. I mean, this is those days when guitarist was king. So even though he wasn't the singer, he was the front man of his follow-up group that he created, the Jeff Beck Group, which had Rod Stewart on vocals. Strangely, Ron Wood, who went on to join the Rolling Stones, played bass in the band. And they were kind of a version of Led Zeppelin before Led Zeppelin. They formed that group and released an incredible record called Truth in 1968.
And then he declined an invitation to play at Woodstock with that band, which is, I guess, maybe was a mistake.
Yeah, you could say he made a few, call them mistakes. He also was asked to join the Rolling Stones after Brian Jones' departure. You know, he was unlike a lot of those similar rock gods like Jimi Hendrix or Eric Clapton or maybe even like Pete Townsend, that he didn't have that singer-songwriter element to his music. And also, unlike Jimmy Page, he didn't necessarily have the ability or the interest in writing those huge, massive hit and iconic songs like he would do in Led Zeppelin. He seemed to really kind of follow his own muse. You know, he kind of veered off into jazz fusion in the 70s. And, you know, it seemed to be I read something about how as a guitar player, he was really frustrated in the 60s because the limitations of the equipment that was available at the time didn't allow him to deliver on the music that was in his head.
Mm. Okay, well, let's hear an example of that. As you say, he collaborated with Stevie Wonder, and here's a track off Stevie Wonder's 1972 album, Talking Book, and this is Looking for Another Pure Love. In my right, so you hear Stevie say, do it, Jeff. That's funny. So yeah, that is really that kind of departure from the shredder of yore. I suppose he's not doing any heavy metal there.
Yeah, I mean, he seemed to be the kind of guy where when you say he was a guitarist's guitarist, I think he was also, you know, if you were a pop singer, if you were a vocalist or a performer and you needed somebody to come in and make a statement on guitar, you know, he had that kind of sideman sensibility where he could come in on whether it was a Donovan song. You know, he played on Tina Turner's Private Dancer. When John Bon Jovi went solo, you know, he called Jeff Beck. Jeff Beck even played with Morrissey. You know, he really was.
And Johnny Depp too recently.
Yeah. I think they did a cover of a John Lennon song during lockdown, cover of Isolation. Yeah, I mean, he was a perfectionist on the guitar, and I think sometimes that maybe didn't necessarily lead to a commercial career in the same way as some of these other guitar gods. But his playing was impeccable and incredibly expressive and lyrical, and he seemed to like always know exactly what to do in the right moment, whatever he was playing on.
All right, let's go out with another collaboration. This one's written by Jimmy Page, and it's called Beck's Bolero. And can you set this one up for us?
Well, this was off of that Jeff Beck Group recording, Truth. Apparently, he recorded it when he was with the Yardbirds, and it's got John Paul Jones on bass, Keith Moon from The Who is on drums. And the song was written by Jimmy Page, even though it's called Beck's Bolero. But I think it's just a song that captures all of the greatness of Jeff Beck's guitar playing in one fantastic performance. It's just, you know, one of those songs that I heard and really put Jeff Beck's guitar playing kind of on the map for me, and really kind of made me take notice, and I've been taking notice ever since.
Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show to remember Jeff Beck.
My pleasure, Madeline.
That's KCRW DJ Dan Wilcox. You can hear him every Saturday evening on his show right here on KCRW between 6 and 8. Coming up, we'll have your weekend film reviews, including a big budget action flick simply called Plane.
Yes, yes, Mike Coulter gets to come out of his handcuffs and be super hunky in a tank top and be all sweaty and hold lots of big guns.
All right, that's next on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk about new movies now for this long holiday weekend with Christy Lemire. She is a film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. Hi, Christy.
Hello, my friend.
Hello. And Whitney Seibold. He contributes to Slash Film and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Whitney, hi.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you both to talk about this week's big theatrical release, Plane, directed by the French director Jean-François Richer. It stars Gerard Butler as a pilot who has to make an emergency landing on his plane on a war-torn island.
This is your captain speaking.
The seatbelt signs have been turned on.
We just lost an engine. Losing altitude.
This island's run by separatists and militias.
My passengers, my responsibility.
Okay, Christy, it's just called Plane. There's no the, so it seems pretty straightforward.
Oh, it's so straightforward. It's exactly what you think it is. It has no greater aspirations. It is lean and mean, and it knows what its purpose is. There is nobody left to fly the plane except for Gerard Butler. Thank God he's here. He is the pilot. He gets to be Scottish this time, which is always exciting. He always seems a little looser when he gets to be his Scottish self. And he is a pilot on kind of a third-rate airline. It's New Year's Eve, and he's making a run from Singapore to Tokyo. All this exposition lays out the fact that he is a widower. His college-age daughter is waiting for him in Hawaii, and he's going to see her eventually. If he can get there, we only have like a hand... he might not. He only has like a handful of passengers, random array of people with zero characteristics, except for the one American guy is a total jerk, of course, and is also a fugitive that is being brought on there, played by Mike Coulter. He has been running for the past 15 years. He's accused of murder, and they just happen to find him in Bali, and they're putting him on this plane to extradite him. So he's
so
in the back
he's
of the
in
plane.
Handcuffs and in yet the back of the he's going to be the guy who saves everyone, right? I'm just
spoilers.
Guessing.
Come on, Madeline.
Sorry.
You're way ahead of us, Marie.
Anything could happen in Plane. Come on. So there's this terrible storm, and they have to fly through it anyway. And Gerard Butler, being a brilliant pilot, figures out how to put the plane down on this tiny island in the Philippines. And so, yes, yes, Mike Coulter gets to come out of his handcuffs and be super hunky in a tank top and be all sweaty and hold lots of big guns as they fight off the separatists. It's very much rated R. It's very bloody. But I had a much better time here than I ever could have imagined.
Wow. Okay, Whitney?
I wish I had some more fun with this movie because... it is completely utilitarian. There is no flair. There's no florid language. There's no exciting shooting. It's just straightforward. Get down to it. It is completely without sophistication. But in a movie that is simply called plane that stars Gerard Butler that is released in January. That's about all you can really expect. And if it hits all of the right beats, then you're getting the correct thrill. It's
don't
kind
you
kind of
want Sylvester Stallone to come storming out of the jungle and save everyone?
It would have been nice to have just somebody with a little bit more violent charisma than Gerard Butler. Gerard Butler is, he's a machine. You just sort of plug him into an action movie and he'll, you know, be Scottish and punch a guy. And if you're into Gerard Butler being Scottish and punching people, then Plane will fill that need. It will fill nothing else. There's no characterization. And you know what? It's January. Let's see Plane.
Sometimes you don't know what you want. They have to serve it to you.
It's nothing. It's just the filling. There's nothing around it.
Okay. Plane in theaters and wide release. Next up, we have Broker, a South Korean drama written and directed by the Japanese filmmaker Kore-eda Hirokazu. Okay, so in that clip, a man tells a young couple, think of us as angels who will look after your precious child. Whitney, tell us more about this movie, what it's about.
This is a movie about the black market for infants in Korea. It's about these characters played by Song Kang-ho and Gang Dong-won, who raid a church's baby box. That is a box where mothers are encouraged to leave the infants they intend to abandon. They note that all of the babies come with little notes, usually from the mother, that say, I'll be back for you. And the mothers don't usually come back. So they sneak into the church, erase the camera footage that a baby has been dropped off, take the baby and sell them to wealthy couples, and they keep the money. This is not the dark thriller that it sounds like, however. In fact, this is a very warm, very emotional, very sentimental film. Hirokazu Kore-eda, he tends to tell stories about cast-offs from society, that the people in society who have been kind of abandoned by the rules. He made a film called Nobody Knows about abandoned children. He also made Shoplifters, about people sort of living on the fringe and needing to steal to survive. And this is about literal abandoned children in Korea. And the two brokers end up teaming up with the mother, who actually does come back to see her baby. And together they sort of form this ersatz family unit as they travel across the country trying to find the correct parents for this infant. And of course, there's going to be extra drama involving the identity of the infant's father and who's going to buy the child. It's a lot more melodramatic in that regard than Hirokazu Kore-eda's other films, which tend to be very kind of dreamy and gentle and sort of formless. It starts to hit really, really hard. So by the end, when people are singing lullabies to one another and talking about being families, you really feel it. The melodrama kind of melts away and it turns into something incredibly emotionally honest. It's very, very touching.
Yeah, and I really loved Shoplifters. I thought that was a beautiful movie, again, about an ersatz family. Christy, what did you think?
Yeah, I love this too. And I feel like, yeah, he's telling this melodramatic story and hitting some really touching beats here, but there's such understatement that they don't feel spoon-fed or mawkish, and the performances are all excellent. Song Kang-ho will break your heart. He was so great in Parasite, and he's so great here again as well.
And he played the dad, right?
He's the dad in Parasite. Yeah, the driver, yeah. The dad in Parasite. And he is playing sort of like a rumpled, shaggy figure, and what he's doing is illegal and extremely questionable. I mean, it raises a lot of ethical questions, because is it better for these kids to go into orphanages, or is it better for Song Kang-ho and his partner to like sell them to a wealthy couple who will ideally give the child a great life? And so there's no judgment here on the part of Kore-eda as far as what is the right path, as far as the ethical or legal nature of what they're doing. And yeah, I loved it. It's really subtle. It reminded me of Little Miss Sunshine.
really?
Like a subtler version of Little Miss Sunshine, in that it is this kind of makeshift family, and they do go on this road trip, and they don't seem to have anything in common.
In a broken down van / microbus.
Yeah, they're in a van here as well. Yeah, there's a funny bit where the van gets pulled over because the hatchback keeps popping open, and just how they improvise on the fly is kind of fun. So yeah, I like this very much.
Okay, Broker in limited release in theaters now. Next up, we have a film called No Bears from award-winning Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi.
Çay buranda iki tane büyük taş var. Biri kızı otudarla sol taşın üstünde. Oğlan da otudarla sağ taşın üstünde.
Dediniz ki oğlan sağ tarafta.
Okay, so in this we see a discussion about a foot washing ceremony and whether the girl is supposed to be on the right and the boy on the left or vice versa. And this is actually Whitney starring Jafar Panahi, even though he has been in prison. He's in prison, I think, for 6 years now.
He's in prison in Iran. Jafar Panahi made a film a few years back called This Is Not a Film about his house arrest. He's been in trouble in Iran for many, many years. And this is a film very much about how he is still driven to create art. He still needs to make films, and how that might not be the healthiest impulse. He plays this fictionalized version of himself, and he's making within the film kind of a melodrama about a couple who is trying to flee Iran and is trying to get passports, which just happens to be the true story of the actors who are enacting in the film within a film. Yeah. The only way he can shoot this movie is over the border. He is shooting remotely. He's watching his directing on a laptop from a small village on the Iranian border while the shooting is happening just over the border in Turkey. And a lot of the film is devoted to the small drama that's happening in that small village while he's shooting, and how he is surrounded by a lot of very superstitious people who feel that his presence there is very disruptive. He takes a photograph at one point, and the villagers all gang up on him about the content of that picture and how that might cause a scandal. The title alludes to the bears that live around the outskirts of the village, that sort of live in the forests. There are, however, no bears. The villagers are afraid to leave, but they're bound in by these imaginary bears.
Obviously a metaphor for the Iranian state.
Yeah. A very clear metaphor for the Iranian state. And it's very heady. It's very cerebral. I feel like he's going to very dark and cold emotional places and not coming to very warm conclusions about the human condition.
Christy, how did he make this film if he was under arrest, or at least at the time, was he under house arrest?
Okay, so no, he was not. So he made this film in early 2022. And soon after he completed it, he was sentenced to 6 years more in prison. But still, part of the story here is that he's on the Iranian border, right on the edge of Turkey, and he's unwilling to cross that border. Like, he'll literally walk right up to that border, but he will not cross it. The folks making the film in Turkey on his behalf want him to come to the set. They're going to smuggle him in for a couple of days. And he's like, I won't. And so this is a physical manifestation of the kind of metaphorical constrictors that he is working with here. It's about people being bound by, you know, societal traditions and rules that are outdated and are cruel, even both in this village, which seems like decades away from any kind of modernization. Like, he's got to like walk around and hold up his phone to get a signal. Like, it's a very rudimentary place. It's so subtle. The magic trick he pulls off here in terms of what's real, what's not, what is fictional, what is commenting on what's actually happening in the world today. But there are these like light moments of interaction between Jafar Panahi and people in this village. There's an elderly woman who is reluctant to have her photograph taken. He's fascinated by her, but she doesn't want any part of it. But like personal one-on-one moments in which he's interacting with people in this town are very enlightening and sometimes even sweet. And so there is a surprising humanity within a film that is, you know, ultimately, you know, very much an indictment of what's going on in Iran right now.
All right. No Bears in select theaters, including the Lemley Royal, beginning tomorrow. Last up, a horror film written, directed, and edited by a Canadian YouTuber named Kyle Edward Ball. This is called Skinamarink.
In this house. In this house. In this house.
Ooh, okay. Christy, that sounds very creepy.
That's like the most dialogue there is in the entire movie, by the way. You found it all.
What's happening? So this is super low budge, right? This movie?
$15,000 is supposedly what it cost to make Skinamarink. So Kyle Edward Ball is this YouTuber, and on his channel, he asked people to write in with their nightmares. And then he would take those and he would film them and make them into YouTube videos. But the theme that came up a lot was, I'm 6 years old, I'm 10 years old, I wake up in the middle of the night in my house and I don't know where I am, my parents are gone, everything is missing or it's all rearranged. That is exactly what this movie is about. It is very amorphous. You've got to really lean in because a lot of the sound design is intended to invoke like 70s horror, a lot of pops, a lot of hisses. And so you have these two kids and you really only hear them. You don't really see them. It's from their point of view, Kevin and Kylie, and they wake up in the middle of the night and he shot it in his childhood home in Alberta. The director did. This is why it cost $15,000 to make. And the kids like walk around and like a window is there and then it's gone. A toilet is there and then it's gone. This is really not for everybody. If you want structure, if you want tension, if you want the kind of pacing that you are accustomed to in a horror movie, this is going to be tough for you. But if you're up for the challenge of like leaning in and like allowing yourself to be, you know, ensconced in the atmosphere, and like there's a whole through line with creepy cartoons that are playing on the TV that illuminate the dark living room. And like, that's something that looks lighthearted and happy, but within this context, it's really disturbing.
Okay. So you should maybe not sit. Well, I guess the whole point is you're sitting there watching this in your dark house thinking, this could happen as I'm watching this.
Yeah. You know what? Some movies I like to refer to as like, you can fold your laundry to this movie and be fine. Like, this is not a fold your laundry movie. This is one where you've got to pay attention because it's like,
okay.
It's like, what? Wait, what did I just see? Where did the window go? So,
Whitney, did you like it?
I did rather make the mistake of watch this in a dark house late at night. And, and I'm still scared. Something about this filmmaking has gotten really, really deep under my skin. And because it's filmed on this sort of old film stock, and the cinematographer scratched up the film so there's actual genuine scratches and pops, your eye is constantly gazing very deeply just into the grain of the film itself. And the filmmakers know how to take that grain and actually have images appear and disappear in it. And so sometimes there are images you're kind of half glimpsing, and it feels so much like a genuine nightmare that you just can't escape the pure unadulterated fright that it's giving you. It really is one of the scarier film experiences I've had recently. It's astonishing how deep this got into me.
Oh, so immersive movie making entirely.
Immersive, experimental, and if you have the patience and you're open to the experience, something very profound.
Kind of like the opposite of Jean Dielman, but similar vibe.
The opposite of Plane. We've got Plane and Skinamarink this week. We've got High and Low.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we need Gerard Butler to root out that thing in Skinamarink.
Oh, he'd find the demon and punch it.
Skinamarink in select theaters today. It's going to stream on Shudder later this year. Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube channel Breakfast All Day, and Whitney Seibold contributes to Slash Film and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, Evan Kleinman tells you how to reimagine the holiday treat panettone, which is still available in stores. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bad like that.
Pie.
The holidays are in the rear view, and for some, that is a relief. For others who want to keep the holiday spirit going, Evan Kleinman is here with an idea. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
You posted on Instagram about a holiday treat you saved to eat after the holidays. Panettone. It's Italian, and it is a cake of sorts. What exactly is it?
It's a bread, actually. I mean, you can tell that from the name, pane, panettone. One mm-hmm. is the suffix that means big, so panettone means big bread. It's an incredibly rich bread, like a brioche on steroids, that is made with honey and egg yolks and eggs and butter and a little bit of candied citrus, raisins. And it has this amazing interior structure. And when I posted that I had bought an extra one for eating for later, and that later was now, it was hilarious, the response I get. There are people hoarding panettone for after the holidays all over the place.
Really? How long does it last?
It lasts months because it has such a rich dough. The dough itself is risen several times, and it's made from a natural yeast. And so it goes through this rising several times. So that's one reason why it lasts so long. And the other is the use of honey, which I think acts as a tenderness reinforcement and also makes it last longer.
And the dough is really light and airy, right?
Yeah, what's really interesting is to watch it while it's being made. And on the web for people, I have a video that I linked to from TikTok of a panettone home cook, which is really hard to do. I mean, it's super impressive. And what I love about this video is you can see the sheets of gluten, how strong the gluten has to be to hold up this incredibly rich bread and have it rise to that beautiful dome that's so characteristic of a good panettone.
Wow, that sounds incredibly difficult. Hence the desire to buy it everywhere. Because you can get it everywhere, right? Trader Joe's, etc. Is it still available?
Yes, it's still available at places who, you know, people, retail spaces never buy too little. They seem to tend to buy too much. So some places will have them on sale, and some places they're still the regular price. But I would say every Italian retail bakery or deli still has them. TJ's might still have them. I know I reached out to Monsieur Marcel in the farmer's market. They still have them and they're 50% off, but nobody go there before I do.
Okay. You're on notice.
Yeah. And I'm sure Italy has some too.
Yeah. That makes sense. It being the Italian bazaar. Okay, so make the case for eating it now and why we should all rush out after you do to go get one.
Well, you know, I'm going to say I bought two because I knew that over the holidays that I would be sharing it with friends and eating it as a dessert and just indulging in it like every day for with my coffee and then in the mid-afternoon with my tea. But I knew that there would come a time when I wanted to do more than that with it. And one of the things, obviously, that one does if one has a surfeit of panettone is make French toast. Mm-hmm. French toast is always kind of a treat, but with panettone, it's just extraordinary because of this crazy open crumb gluten structure that it has. And then also bread pudding. I love making bread pudding with panettone. And I'm not a big one for fancy inclusions in panettone. I don't like the ones that have chocolate or cream. But with bread pudding, I'll add like a lot of chunks of chocolate. So the chocolate as it melts kind of pools. So when you eat it warm, you get this beautiful, rich bread pudding and then a pool of chocolate in your mouth.
Oh, that sounds so good. Okay, some of these Panettone, even though, as you say, they might be on sale, can be kind of pricey. Some high-end stores charge close to $100. So how much should we expect to spend?
Yeah, and I have to say, part of that is the packaging. The packaging of Panettone is a thing unto itself and is this just marvelous present that you're either giving to someone else or you're giving to yourself. The ones at Trader Joe's are probably between $20 to $35. They might be below $20, but I'm not sure this year. The one I bought this year, which was imported from Italy, was $60, and with shipping, it was $75. It was made in the Veneto region from a bakery called Biasetto. And, you know, I don't treat myself to a lot of stuff throughout the year, so for me, it's a treat that I allow myself to have every holiday.
Okay, and you say it can last a long time. Can it last till next year? The next holiday season?
I mean, one of my big disappointments was going to a very well-recognized Italian deli and buying a panettone and getting it home and it was moldy. And that really made me sad. But, I think they'll still be good for another month or so. I mean, the one that I just opened, it's perfect. It's just absolutely perfect. One of the things I love to do, I mean, especially in this weather, and I know people are going to judge me when I reveal this, but sometimes I like to make myself like a child coffee. Like I take instant, yes, I'm saying the word instant, Cafe Bustelo, and I make it with hot milk. And then I rip pieces of panettone and let them soak in there and then just fish them out with the spoon.
It sounds delicious. I think visually maybe not so hot, but I'm sure it tastes delicious.
Some things are just meant to be intimate. I shared a very intimate thing with you.
I know. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I like the sound of it. I'm not too keen on the visuals, but I'm...
And, of course, I will share... recipes on our website for everyone.
Recipes to make
French toast and bread pudding.
Oh, okay. We're not going to attempt to make a panettone.
I mean, that's a year-long process. If you want to start now for next year and you don't mind the expense and the time and you think that you can read Italian, which isn't that hard from a culinary standpoint, there's an amazing book called Cresci, C-R-E-S-C-I, that I recommend.
Okay. For all of you ambitious A-types, go for it. The rest of us are going to go to Trader Joe's. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. What's on your show this week?
Well, this week is particularly interesting because just a few days ago, I interviewed Renee Redzepi. And I woke up to the news in the New York Times, as did many people, that Noma is closing in 2024. So if you listen carefully to our conversation, you can hear hints that something is afoot.
And for people who don't know, Noma is considered the best restaurant in the world.
Right, right. We're also going to start having New York Times columnist Tejal Rao join us on Good Food regularly. And so she starts this week with a conversation about the remarkable woman, Madame Wu.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, well, that's Good Food. You can hear it on Saturday mornings at 10 on KCRW or wherever you get your podcasts. Evan Kleiman, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go make some coffee with panettone soaked in it now.
That does sound really good. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hordzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Marcel Hutchins. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. And our technical director is the ever super Mario Saavedra. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, at KCW Press Play, and you can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I am at The Mad Brand, and you can download and subscribe to our podcast at kcw.com/pressplay. Have a great 3-day weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Tuesday.